You are listening to a podcast produced by the Jackson School of International Studies and the Ellison Center for Russian, East European, and Central Asian Studies at the University of Washington. This and other podcasts can be found on iTunes and SoundCloud. For more information, visit us at jsis.washington.edu/Ellison Center.
Okay, so I want to welcome everyone, and especially I want to welcome Dr. Martin Nikola. It's my great pleasure to welcome him back to Seattle. He's been at least two times, maybe more, to the Pacific Northwest.
Yep.
And he's a political scientist and a historian. His education he got at Charles University in Prague. He's, among other things, a postdoctoral fellow at Columbia University. He's researched at various archives around the U.S. and around the world, and YIVO Institute and Hoover Institute. And he's published several books. He's published countless articles. He's an expert on non-democratic societies, particularly on communist societies. He's a specialist in Central European exiles and refugees during Cold War period. And he's a specialist on Czechs around the world, and they're all over the world, Dominican Republic and Pacific Northwest. And his most recent book is Czechs in the Northwest, Idaho, Montana, Oregon, and Washington. And so I encourage you to get a copy of this book. It has, it's amazing how many Czechs there are in the Northwest and the presence they've had over the years, which I think sometimes gets overlooked. I want to thank our sponsors, the RECUS program of the Jackson School of International Studies at UW, the Honorary Consulate of the Czech Republic, and the University of Washington Department of History. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Martin Nikola as he speaks on war in Ukraine, impact on the Czech Republic and on Europe.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Good afternoon. It is a great pleasure to be back to Seattle. We have a beautiful weather, and everyone is so excited by my lecture that we were not able to find a parking lot, you know. So many people outside with my posters, you know, waiting for my signature. It's incredible. So thank you very much for a warm welcome. I'm a historian, doing research mostly on the Czechs in America. But I'm also a political scientist. In fact, technically, I'm a political scientist. I got my PhD in political science at the Charles University in Prague. So I'm interested in political systems, in party systems, election systems. From time to time, I take part in the election observation missions organized by the OSCE, which is the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. And today I was asked to tell you something about the ongoing war in Ukraine and how did it impact, how did it affect other European countries, including the Czech Republic, where I come from. As you know, my country is just in the very heart of Europe, so it's always heavily relied on, or depended on a larger German economy, and most of our foreign trade is with the other member states of the European Union, so the war has changed a lot. I think that now we are living in an exciting times, although, you know, despite all the horrors and tragedies, I think that it is a great opportunity, not just for Ukraine, but for the whole European Union to start over. I think we'll be reading about these times in the history books very soon, because just what happened in terms of Euro-Russian relations in the past 13 months, that's incredible. You know, the frozen assets of the Russian Central Bank, we were able to lower our dependency on Russian gas from 97% before the war to 4% only now, within the past year. You know, so it's really incredible what happened, all the sanctions. Well, I'll talk about it a bit later. I'm glad that you're interested in this topic. I'm sure there are many specialists on Ukraine and you know a lot of details about Ukraine and its history, but still for the rest let me start with a very brief introduction. Maybe we can turn the lights off so that you can see the slides. Yeah, and we can move to the first. that's on me. So, as you know, Ukraine is a country in Eastern Europe with beautiful nature, mountains, Black Sea, fertile land, and above all, brave, proud, and friendly people. The land has a total area of 233,000 square miles, which is approximately 87% of the area of Texas. So for the European standards, it's pretty big country. Actually, it's the 45th largest country in the world. Before the war, it had a population of some 43, 44 million, and 70% of them lived in the cities. The history of Ukraine, or of Ukrainian territory, has always been very dramatic. Over the past 10 centuries, Ukraine has repeatedly been carved up by competing powers. Mongol warriors from the east conquered Kiev and Rus in the 13th century. In the 16th century, it was the Polish and Lithuanian armies who invaded from the west. In the 17th century, there was this war between the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth and the Tsardom of Russia that brought lands to the east of the Dnieper River under Russian imperial control. Southern regions, including the Crimean Peninsula, were part of the Ottoman Empire. More than a century later, in 1793, the right bank Ukraine was annexed by the Russian Empire. And over years that followed, the policy known as Russification banned the use of and the use and study of Ukrainian language, and people were pressured to convert to the Russian Orthodox faith. Nevertheless, Ukraine suffered some of its greatest traumas during the 20th century. After the Communist Revolution of 1917, Ukraine was one of the many countries to fight a brutal civil war before being fully absorbed into the Soviet Union in 1922. In the early 1930s, to force peasants to join collective farms, Soviet leader Joseph Stalin orchestrated a famine that resulted in the starvation and death of millions of people. And afterwards, Stalin also imported large numbers of Russians and other Soviet citizens with, you know, no ability to speak Ukrainian or with no ties to the region to help to repopulate certain parts of Ukraine. The westernmost part of Ukraine, the so-called Zakarpattia region or Podkarpatska Rus, belonged to Czechoslovakia in the interwar period. But the majority of its population was Hungarian, Jewish, and Rusyn, which was and still is a very small Slavic nation with its specific language, religion, and traditions. After the Nazis attacked the Soviet Union in June 1941, Ukraine witnessed probably the most brutal atrocities, genocide, ethnic cleaning, and war crimes of all occupied territories in the East. And after World War II ended, the re-established Soviet power continued with further terror. And forced population movements. So historically, as you could have seen at a previous map, there was no single Ukraine. The eastern part came under Russian imperial control much earlier than the western part. So even the people in the east have stronger ties to Russia and have been more likely to support Russian-leaning leaders or politicians. Western Ukraine, by contrast, spent centuries under the shifting control of European powers. As I said, it was Poland, then it was Austria or Austrian-Hungarian Empire. Zakarpattia was part of Czechoslovakia and Hungary. So this is one of the reasons why the Ukrainians in the West have recently tended to support more Western-leaning politicians. With the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, Ukraine became an independent country, as you know, but uniting the country and the nation proved a very difficult task. The sense of Ukrainian patriotism and awareness of a unique national history was also much deeper in the West, I would think. And also the transition to democracy and capitalism was in many cases painful and chaotic. And many people, especially the ones in the East, longed for the relative stability, social benefits, and assured employment of the earlier periods under the Soviet Union. As you can see here, even the results of the presidential and parliamentary elections in the past 2 decades show obvious differences in voters' preferences and support to political parties and candidates on both banks of Dnieper River. So a dangerous combination of kind of Soviet nostalgia, corruption reaching from the lowest local, meaning municipal level or municipal administrations, up to the central government. Also unfulfilled populist promises, ineffective reforms, and power struggles between unscrupulous oligarchs led to further dissatisfaction and unrest in the society. And then November 2013 came and the beginning of the so-called Euromaidan revolution, caused by the decision of the pro-Russian president Viktor Yanukovych to reject the association agreement with the European Union. As you know, this led to huge manifestations in Kiev and other cities, lasting for a couple of months. And these events eventually led to the overthrow of Yanukovych. And the Russian-speaking population in the east saw it, thanks to the very intensive media massage by Kremlin propaganda channels, as an unlawful coup d'etat orchestrated by the West, by the United States, by the Western spies, and thus the, I would say, abyss of misunderstanding between the people in the West and the East even deepened. Right after, the uprisings in Donetsk and Luhansk regions, backed by Moscow, began, and also the Russian military occupation and annexation of the Crimean Peninsula in late February 2014. And now, some 9 years after, 9 years later, we continue to see the consequences, and even worse, the ongoing war, called Special Military Operation by the Kremlin, brought an entirely new geopolitical situation that affected not just Ukraine, not just Russia, but many other countries. It basically changed the whole European continent, and as I said, also gave to Ukraine a great and unrepeatable chance to start over. Now let me make a brief pause and share my personal experience from Ukraine. As I mentioned, I had a chance to visit the Zakarpattia region several times as a tourist, and had a great time when hiking and exploring the mountains. In addition, my own grandfather was born there in 1934 when it was part of Czechoslovakia, because his parents used to work in the salt mines in the place called Solotvino. And above all, I take part in the election observation missions in Ukraine. I came twice in May 2014 for the presidential election, and then for the parliamentary election in October 2014. Yeah, it might be right. So I had a chance to observe the election in the capital, in Kiev. I was also in Kharkiv, which is the second largest Ukrainian city in the east, just 20 miles from Russian border. I was also in Ivano-Frankivsk, in the western part of the country. I visited numerous, villages and small polling stations in the remote areas. Here are a few pictures. You can see here one of the small polling stations in the countryside. The one on the top is the monument or statue of Vladimir Ilyich Lenin, actually the largest one in Eastern Europe. It was placed in the middle of Freedom Square in Kharkiv. And only a few weeks after the election, it was toppled and demolished. And the other two photos on the top come from Kiev, actually from Maidan, from the square. And you still can see the charred buildings, tents, barricades, basically the remains of the revolution or of the unrest. And below, it's me at 6 a.m. at the beginning of a very, very, very long shift during the E-Day. Here, I'm still full of energy and optimism and expectations, but not for long. Don't misunderstand me, I'm not biased. I have deep sympathies for Ukrainians. I have many friends among them, and I even have studied Ukrainian language at the university for some 2 years. However, when I was there, I came to understand that the country was in a very deep troubles, even without any Russian interference. I mentioned that before, the level of corruption, kind of Soviet mindset, backwardness. Just a few miles from Kiev, you came to a different world. Underdeveloped villages with no proper infrastructure, with no money, no hopes, basically no light at the end of the tunnel for most of the people who didn't have the right connections and didn't have enough money to bribe the authorities. And the elections were actually a great example. On paper, everything looked perfect. There was a new election law based on EU recommendations. All procedures were followed. Members of the election committees seemed to be very well prepared and competent. The voters were excited and the turnout was actually very high, something between 70 and 75%, if I remember correctly. But during the E-Day, we realized there was something fishy. We saw obvious intimidation of voters. We saw some unnecessary bureaucratic obstacles. We saw campaigning in front of the polling stations, although it was already banned or forbidden during the E-Day. Sometimes even the secrecy of voting wasn't ensured. And there was this strange role of police officers and of military officials. And above all, there were very strange guys in the black leather jackets with three cell phones, you know. They were present at every single polling station. They were receiving orders from someone else, you know, and they were the real bosses on site. They were the ones who were responsible. They were giving orders and recommendations on how to proceed to the, even to the chairman of the polling, of the election committees. And we saw them even later at the district election committee, meaning the place where the most important part of the E-Day took place, the counting and the tabulation process. So it was very strange, but to be fair, I met the very same types also in Belarus, in Armenia, in Georgia, meaning the country of Georgia, although your state of Georgia might need some election observation as well, right? And you can always recognize them, as I said, black leather jackets, too many rings, three cell phones, and also white socks and the half shoes. Let me emphasize, this was not the fault of ordinary Ukrainians. It was just the fault of the system they were living in. You know, the system that looked nice, looked transparent, but in fact, it was kind of fake and rotten in many ways. It was developed and deformed by the oligarchs, by the crooked politicians, whose only concern was to keep the power and to embezzle as much money as possible, not to help the people, not to contribute to a healthy progress of the country as a whole. So I felt very sorry about that, and actually my Ukrainian friends shared the very same frustration. So this was the situation back in 2014. You know, since then, Ukraine undoubtedly made an incredible jump towards becoming a modern European country with a strong civil society, with democratic institutions and control mechanisms. But I think that still some issues remained unresolved, and there were still too many, you know, elephants in the room. Above all, this Soviet legacy and, you know, some strong ties to strong ties with Russia, and Ukraine was only halfway to being considered a real candidate for EU membership, for example. But you know that Ukraine has applied already. But based on my experience, I don't think it will happen within the next 10 years that Ukraine joins the European Union, but we'll see. Therefore, again, I believe that the ongoing war, although it's an unspeakable tragedy and catastrophe, might also become a unique opportunity for Ukraine, for Ukrainian people, to start over, to break free of the shackles of the past, to gain a new confidence and to build new national identity. You know, for example, in my country, in the Czech Republic, for the past 30 years, Ukrainians were mostly seen as a cheap labor force. Tens of thousands of Ukrainians were coming to Czechia every year as seasonal workers in agriculture, as construction workers, workers in factories. So thanks to Ukrainian men, we have our highways, our subway system in Prague, houses and shopping centers. Thanks to Ukrainian women, our corridors and offices are clean, our shirts are ironed, our gardens are well maintained, our packages are delivered. So it is my sincere hope that after this terrible war, we will also acknowledge and admire Ukrainians as heroes, as fighters, as defenders of freedom and democratic values. As we know, the Russian invasion of Ukraine began on the morning of February 24th of last year, when Vladimir Putin announced this special military operation to demilitarize and denazify Ukraine. This unprovoked and unjustified aggression that brought military conflict into the heart of Europe after so many decades also caused many unexpected consequences. First of all, the 27 member states of the European Union, after Great Britain left in 2016, is just 27 of us, And in the past few years, it was very complicated. You know, there were too many issues that made the kind of coexistence and cooperation under one flag of the European Union very difficult, very challenging. And it was, you know, really not easy because of the individual political and economic interests of the member countries. And there were many issues that even deepened misunderstandings between the old members, meaning the Western members, and the new members, meaning the countries in Central and Eastern Europe that joined the Union in 2004, like the Czech Republic and Slovakia, later 2008 and in 2013 when Croatia joined the Union. It was the bankruptcy of Greece, it was the Brexit in 2016, it was the migration crisis, and also attitudes towards Russia that were reasons for serious discords reaching a common European solution became almost impossible. The crucial German economy depended by 65% on Russian gas. Hungary and Cyprus were always considered kind of Trojan horses of the Kremlin in the European Union. And also many Italian politicians, Austrian politicians, even the candidate for the presidency of France, Marine Le Pen, expressed vocal sympathies towards Putin. And after the annexation of Crimea in 2014, the EU only raised a warning finger and introduced just a limited sanctions with no real harm for Russia. So after February 24th of last year, everyone was kind of tensely awaiting what the response of the EU would be. This time, fortunately, the European Union has shown an incredible unity and strength and has provided Ukraine with significant political, financial and military support and, of course, humanitarian aid to refugees. The Czech Republic, for example, country of 10.5 million people, has accepted more than 500,000 of refugees so far, which is, you know, technically like 5% of the population. And some 85% of them are women and children. In addition, the European Union adopted a whole scale of sanctions against Russia and Belarus. The Union agreed on 10 sanction packages so far. These included the prohibition on transactions with the Russian banks, suspension of Russian broadcasting and propaganda channels in the European Union, prohibition on most of the imports from Russia, sanctions against companies and individuals linked with the Kremlin, and freezing or confiscation of their property, and also more restrictive rules for Russian citizens when applying for visas. Now it's more expensive, it takes longer time, it's much more complicated. And you can even see it in a daily life. For example, you probably know the town Karlovy Vary or Karlsbad, which is just at the border of Germany, some 2 hours from Prague. And before the war, it was full of Russians. You know, most of the property was owned by the Russians, there were Russian signs, all the hotels, restaurants, bars were owned by the Russians. Not anymore. I was there in the summer and, you know, it looks like a ghost town because the tourists were gone and the Russian money was gone, the Russian investments. But you can, you know, feel it. You can feel some change that they simply left the country, and probably the same happened with other European countries. So going back to the sanctions, above all, this drastic reduction of Russian banking and finance sector was very painful to Moscow. The same with energy, with transportation, with new technologies. And experts say that the Russian economy would need at least 20 years to fully recover if the war ended today. So with further escalation of the conflict, the consequences cannot be predicted. On the other hand, the war is having a disruptive effect on global markets. Since the conflict began, there has been a sharp increase in world prices of key commodities, in particular fuel and crops, because, as you know, Ukraine was the world's largest producers, exporting even to Africa and China and Australia. And due to the blockade of Ukrainian ports in the Black Sea by Russian vessels, the products simply couldn't reach the customers. In the cases the countries in the African Horn, in Eastern Africa, suffering from a disastrous drought, the stoppage of Ukrainian grain aggravated famine and created another very serious humanitarian crisis. It's simply the cost of war, right? Even in the Czech Republic, the price of gas and oil doubled or even tripled in some cases. Now it's a bit better, but in the summer of last year, the situation was very serious. Just for you to know, we had to pay like $8 per gallon for regular gas, which is much more than in here, right? Of course, at the beginning, the support for Ukraine was very high among the people because, you know, I think that many Czechs felt or saw it as a kind of historical comparison with what happened to us back in 1968 when we were occupied by the Soviets, and even back in 1938 after the so-called Munich Agreement, when the Western powers agreed to give up, you know, or to give Hitler our border territories with a German-speaking population. These two events had a devastating effect on nation's soul, and you can see the consequences even today. You know, it's always 1938 and always 1968, these two events, and we, you know, sometimes we use them as an excuse for what is happening in the Czech Republic now. So I think that the very strong support for Ukraine at the beginning of the conflict was also, you know, caused by this, that we didn't want to let happen that the same would happen to Ukraine, that the larger neighbor, the more powerful neighbor, simply decides to occupy a neighboring country and no one can stop him. So it was really, you know, I felt it every day. You saw desperate groups of immigrants, of refugees, you know, who arrived to the main station in Prague with bags. You know, they were lost, they didn't know where to go, and in a few seconds someone just reached them, you know, started to talk to them, tried to help them, tried to find a humanitarian organization nearby, gave them a ride, give them some money, invited them for lunch, etc. Small things, but it had some meaning, you know. Of course, as long the war lasts, the lower the support is. But according to the latest polls, still a vast majority of the population strongly stands behind Ukraine, between 65, 70, maybe 75%. Of course, more and more people are starting to argue and starting to criticize the government, which had, you know, very bold plans to restart our economy after the pandemic, and suddenly most of the money went to Ukraine. Of course, people are starting to argue. So why don't you, you know, raise the salaries? Why don't you do something with the inflation? As we speak, the inflation rate in the Czech Republic is between 18 and 20%. So it's a lot, you know. But yeah, it's simply the cost of war. Fortunately, we were able to replace the Russian oil, gas supplies by the liquefied natural gas coming from Norway, from Qatar, or even from the United States. It's distributed to the Czech Republic through a special terminal in Netherlands. So that went well. But still, half of Czechia's oil comes from Russia, and we still need to find a new supplier of raw materials for two nuclear power plants. Actually, I think it happened just a few days ago when we signed some agreement with Westinghouse company, so that should be taken care of as well. So our oil and energy dependence on supplies from Russia is obvious, and it also needs to be seen as a security threat in the long term, because, you know, Kremlin doesn't hesitate to use gas and oil as political weapon and instrument of pressure. We also see the rise of populism or populist tendencies. Our political system is a bit different than the one in the United States. We have a parliamentary system, so we have a two chambers of the parliament, the House and the Senate. It's the Prime Minister who is actually the head of the government. And then we also have the president, who is kind of a head of state and also a supreme leader of, he's in charge of the army as well. So we have seven political parties in the parliament, and our current government is comprised of five different parties. They are doing well, but again, you know, it's five parties, so reaching a common solution and, you know, decision how to speak with one voice, it's more complicated than if the government was formed by one or two parties only. As I said, the government had some plans how to restart the economy, and suddenly they had to change their plans and focus on Ukraine. On March the 17th, meaning just 3 weeks ago, the Czech Republic signed into law a package of three government bills, collectively referred to in the media as Lex Ukraine, providing the war refugees with health insurance, access to the labor market with no restrictions, humanitarian allowance, social services, childcare, etc., etc. In exchange, I would assume the Czech companies expect that they will be allowed to participate significantly in the restoration of Ukraine when the war is over. There is this kind of newly formed populist and anti-establishment movement in the Czech Republic, involving a very strange mixture of communists, socialists, as well as far-right radicals, and also supporters of a political party called Freedom and Direct Democracy, which even has 22 seats out of 200 in our lower house. And this movement began to spread the narrative, stressing worsening macroeconomic conditions, above all, you know, the high inflation. They say that we are going to suffer, we are going to freeze during the winter, we are going to lose money and living standards only due to our support of Ukraine. And they present a very simplified solution. The war is just a minor regional conflict between Russia and Ukraine. We should not intervene. Weapon supplies mean only, you know, more prolongation and extension of the conflict. They say that the best solution would be to force Ukraine to give up part of its territory, thus satisfy Russia, which will withdraw its troops. The war will be over and everyone will be happy again. So they say they are the only ones calling for peace. But in fact, if you examine closer their communication with the public and the content of their appeals and messages in the social media, for example, it's full of anti-European, anti-American, anti-West and xenophobic narratives, depicting Putin and his regime as guardians of traditional values and Christianity, defending them from Western decline and decadence. Not a single word about the war, not a single word about war crimes, about bomb cities, about, you know, kidnapped children and other atrocities committed by the aggressors. So there is an obvious bias and prejudice. But again, as I say, for now, I call them the false populist saviors attract only a fragment of the population, between 5 to 8%. I also think that the solution for Ukraine won't be too simple, because based on my experience, I don't think it is possible just to dig a hole or an abyss between the Ukrainians and the Russians, because these two nations are closely tied. I saw it in Kharkiv, where I observed the elections. Kharkiv, just again, it's 20 miles from Russian border, Russian-speaking population. So I talked to the locals, I asked them, so do you consider yourselves, you know, being Russians or Ukrainians, or what is your feeling? And they all responded, no, we are Ukrainians, we are very proud of that, we don't want to become part of Russia, we just use Russian as our official, you know, first language. They were, you know, mixed couples, there were no real boundaries, meaning the Ukrainians were able to go for work to Russia. There was a very, you know, trade exchange between Kharkiv region and and the cities and the Russian part. So I always, you know, try to think in a historical framework, and I'm trying to compare the current situation with our history. You know that the Czechs and the Germans used to live in the Czech lands for 1,000 years together, but after World War II, we simply expelled 3.5 million of our Germans, and that was the end of the common history. And that happened with the consent of the Allies, and that was over. Since then, the Czech Republic or Czechoslovakia back then was just a, you know, a single nation country. I mean the Czech lands, the Czech part. So I don't think this can happen in Ukraine, because of course, you know, the war is a great turning point. So many things will be different after the war. I might liken it to perhaps to the situation in Yugoslavia after the civil war, when, for example, the Croatians tried to get rid of the common history or the common past with the Serbians. They started to pretend that they have nothing in common with the Serbians. They were changing their grammar, and they were inventing new vocabulary. And they were abusing Latin alphabet. So they were simply trying to, you know, to draw a red line and to end the common history with the Serbians. It might happen in Ukraine as well, but, you know, who knows? I think it's still too early to make the final decision how the war might end. Yeah, there are possible 5 scenarios of the development. First of all, might be the victory of Russia. You know, that would probably lead to a change of government and the partition of Ukraine. All the Moscow's objectives would thus be fulfilled: consolidation of the annexation of Crimea, recognition of the separatist republics of Donetsk and Luhansk, disarmament of the Ukrainian army, and basically also the end to Ukraine's initiatives to join the European Union and NATO. It might also happen that Ukraine will win, and this case would be also, you know, catastrophic for Russia. It might affect Putin's continuity in government, or leading the leader to increase internal repression and isolation of the country, of Russia. And that's been already happening, right, for some time now. Number 3 is negotiated exit. You know, a ceasefire and the peace negotiations between Russia and Ukraine would end the war, but would not necessarily bring a solution to the issue of Crimea and the Donbas territories raised back in 2014, even if Kiev formally recognizes the situation. But both sides of the conflict will be able to claim a partial victory, and the international community could then seek to lift sanctions and restore trade relations, although tensions will continue. It is unclear, however, how long it might take, and you know, to reach a deal, and if it happens, how long it might survive. Number 4, it's I call it uncontrolled climbing or escalation. In this scenario, Russia's military failure in its attempt to take control of the whole of Ukraine becomes evident, but Putin rejects any withdrawal and decides to escalate the conflict, probably by threatening to use nuclear arsenal. Of course, the consequences of this escalation or escalation to this level could be unimaginable for the planet, but who knows? And scenario number 5, I called stagnation. Russia's advance stalls on all fronts, but the invading forces fortify their positions and hold on to the conquered territory. The Ukrainians, meanwhile, have a defense that Russia cannot penetrate, but they have difficulty going on to the offensive. And the conflict in this way, and in the face of the failure of the peace talks, decreases in intensity and becomes a war of position or a frozen conflict, similar to the one that has confronted the separatists in Donbas and the Ukrainian government since 2014. And this could last for 4 years or even for decades. Here you can have the map showing the front or the situation on the battlefield since September. So you can see that isn't moving much. and hasn't moved much in the past few months. But they're saying that Ukraine is planning a huge offensive in the upcoming weeks. So we'll see if they succeed. Yeah, so that will be it. Thank you very much for your attention. If you want to spare my vocal cords, then feel free to email me your questions electronically. Otherwise, I'm ready and I'm happy to answer your questions right now. Thank you.